the last vote of 2014 on the marriage amendment. Will there ever be another? Senator Mike Delf in the spotlight, trouble for the governor's pre-K proposal, and the latest on a possible Medicaid expansion. That plus tragedy averted at Assembly Hall and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending February 21, 2014.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.
This week, the state Senate passed a weakened version of the marriage amendment, bringing the gay marriage debate to an end for this year. The vote was 32-17 to pass the proposed permanent ban on gay marriage. It's still alive, but there will be no referendum until at least 2016. That's why the celebration by gay marriage supporters was subdued. They won a battle when the second sentence banning civil unions was removed, but there may be new battles ahead. The somber debate in the state Senate focused on equal rights and morality.
We cannot allow prejudice or contempt to be clothed in religious or moral convictions. Your religion, your religious beliefs are your business, but they should not be used as justification for laws that discriminate against others.
I'm going to vote to keep it going because maybe to give us one last stand.
Yes, so we definitely made a lot of progress. No one thought we would be here, 6 months ago when Freedom Indiana started.
Who won the marriage battle? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanes, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV State House reporter Jim Shella. Mike McDaniel, was this a victory for Freedom Indiana?
I think it was a victory for the process, for starters. I think the issue was debated the way it should be. And, it was a spirited discussion, but one where everybody at least treated themselves in a civil manner. And all the people that showed up at the State House from the public handled it well, and we had no problems there. And I thought it was pretty well done, actually.
Well, you get to the bottom line. There's still a marriage amendment alive, but there's no referendum this year. It'll all be considered another day. There's a little something for everybody in that, right? No?
I think there's a lot more for Freedom Indiana in that. I think the governor's made it crystal clear the last thing in the world he wants is this on the ballot in 2016. So I think it's dead. And, you know, when you ask who wins and who loses, all you have to do is look at the faces of Mike Delf and Kurt Smith and Scott Snyder and you know who won and who lost. And, you know, frankly, it was a victory against bigotry. And that's a good thing. That's a good, positive development. And I think there was national press on this for Indiana and for the employers that were lobbied so hard for this and the universities that were courageous enough to take the stand. Not all of them were, but most of our higher education institutions did, and that's all a big victory for them.
Kurt Smith of the Indiana Family Institute was one of the point people pushing for this. He called it a setback. He doesn't like to call it a defeat, but clearly they were disappointed.
I think they had reason to be disappointed because at the beginning of the process, they, us, and everyone else thought that this would be on the ballot this year, and it's not going to be. So I think that definitely is a setback, if not a defeat, for the folks who were for HJR 3. But I guess if you want to look at it optimistically from their perspective, the issue is still alive. And there is no definitive end yet, so they still have this issue to use as they see fit, and the battle will still continue, though not as out in front as it has been the last couple of months.
It's going to be an issue in campaigns, but probably not very many.
Probably not, because the filing deadline for primary contests took place in a manner that probably shut the door on some people who might have been motivated by proceedings and votes in the Senate or in the State House this session. So there really aren't a lot of contested races, and I'm not sure how many of the general election contests would hinge on an issue like this, and not nearly the way it might have in the primary. So if you want to frame this as reason for optimism by advocates of the amendment, yes, but if we want to engage in sports metaphor here, which I know Ann always enjoys, I mean, they started out with all the time, you know, all four quarters, right, if it's football, and now, because of the way society's changing, I mean, the clock is, they're running out of time.
Quarters in basketball, yeah. You know, halves in football.
Well, the reality is, this started in 2004, right, in the General Assembly. Right. We're now 10 years later, right, and it's still not going to the ballot. And the longer time goes on, the less likely.
That's why I really do think it's dead. And I actually think that the supporters of this are paper tigers. They talked about the ramifications that were going to happen to Republicans who went the wrong way in the primary. Three contests arguably are about this. So they didn't mount the kind of support that they said they would for this against incumbent Republicans. And I frankly think their day has passed.
So Brian Bosma yesterday said that somebody offered him unlimited campaign contributions if he would kill this, and that somebody offered someone in his district $500,000 to run against him because of this.
I hope somebody took that.
Yeah,
they didn't.
Oh, yeah. No. What's the point he's trying to make at this stage?
Well, the emotions were so high, and a lot of people were trying to throw a lot of money at this problem. What's interesting about that is they didn't put their money into paid advertising. We hardly saw any paid advertising.
We saw a little bit from Eric Miller's group.
Not more than probably enough to maybe, $20,000 worth of paid advertising in this thing? So really the debate took place between the groups and the grassroots organizations, and I think that was probably a healthy thing because it wasn't a bunch of national money coming in from all sides.
Freedom Indiana spent a lot of money. They had 37 people on staff.
They did it trying to communicate individually with legislators, not in the mass media, which would have changed the whole look of this thing. I'd be surprised if this issue affects more than maybe 3 to 5 races out of the 125 that are up in this election.
Still with this, State Senator Mike Delf called a news conference prior to the Senate vote. Delf is a supporter of the proposed ban on gay marriage, and he's upset about the way GOP leaders controlled the debate in the state Senate. When he called reporters together in the State House Rotunda, there was speculation that he would challenge Republican leader David Long or that he might leave the Republican caucus. He did neither, instead announcing only that he would vote against the marriage amendment in its current form so the debate will end. He also talked about his brother Steve, who is openly gay.
For some reason, we fear rigorous and in-depth public debate. I embrace it. I relish it. It makes me better. It makes me more informed. It helps shape my thinking. I love my brother, and I accept him as a human being, but I don't accept the lifestyle of homosexuality. I think it's wrong.
And Delaney, will his position make him vulnerable in the November election?
Well, that's a tough district, but he certainly has done his best to put it in contention. I cannot believe he says he wants open and spirited debate about this, and then he rants against anybody, even people in his own district, who disagree with him. He may not have challenged Republican leadership, but I think the Republican Party has left him behind, and judging by the way they've moved his seat and the way they've taken his leadership position, they are not comfortable with him, and those people who elected him to the Senate are without, in effect, a senator who can represent them.
Subsequent to the events surrounding the vote, he's been disciplined because of a tweet that he sent out from a Republican caucus. He disclosed what was discussed in a Republican caucus, and so they took away a low-level leadership position. They moved him into what was a Democrat seat on the Senate floor. That doesn't happen very often. That's severe punishment.
No, it doesn't happen very often. And I think it was important that they do something along those lines, because the rule, as we talked about here last week, is what goes on in caucus stays in caucus. And you're supposed to have a spirited debate there. That's where the family discussion takes place. And then once a decision's made, everybody stands by that. But when you tweet the outcome of that discussion before you ever leave the room, when you're supposed to not talk about what goes on in that room, you've broken the code. And when you do that, you make other people in that caucus angry, and he did that by doing this, even some of the people that were his own allies by doing it the way he did it on the issue. And so they felt compelled to discipline him, and they did. And he accepts that, I'm told, that he understands.
Well, he's not talking right now. He says he'll talk next week.
Well, I saw a quote where he said, "I accept my discipline, and I'll have a comment again next week."
Yeah. So he doesn't have any choice but to accept it.
Well, that's exactly right.
Well, the irony, too, was the leadership position in question was, what, assistant majority leader specifically for communication. I mean, his role had been when he received
this
role.
He's doing fine with communication. Message, maybe.
Maybe that's... but it is irony that effectively, I presume that position is seen as something of a mouthpiece for the caucus or the party. So maybe he was just overzealous in trying to get the word out. But there may be other ramifications or repercussions as well. And I'm not an attorney, but there were comments made about the conduct of federal judges
And he is an attorney.
He is an attorney, a member of the bar. And people like Ann, who are attorneys, tell me that you tread on dangerous ground when you take on people verbally
in robes. Especially when the attacks are so ill-informed. He doesn't even know what he's talking about.
Well, how long can he recover from this? How long does it take to recover?
Well, it'll take some time. He can recover from this, but it's up to him if he wants to. You know, the act of having that news conference is really, you know, I know he wasn't punished for that, but that's open defiance of the caucus as well. And he shows no inclination to stop that. So if they're looking for contrition, I doubt they're going to find that from Senator Delf. And so, you know, he may never get back in the good graces of the Republican Party, and he may not want to.
Well, go ahead.
No, what's sad about this to me is that this is a guy who actually works at being a legislator. He reads bills. He seems to try to do his homework. He doesn't always come up with the conclusions that you hope he will. But still, you know, he's taken an ability to be a good legislator and kind of thrown it away with these kind of
tirades. He's handicapping himself.
Sure he is. And that's whether you recover from that, so you have to be seen.
And he has to have somebody besides the ideological godfather of Rush Limbaugh out there to follow. I mean, he wants to blow things up.
Everybody's allowed to interpret these things the way they want to do it.
But regardless of his point of view, his approach is
sure. That's my point. He wants to blow it up. He says he wants discussion, but then he rants against anybody who disagrees with him.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question is, was Mike Delf's behavior senatorial? Your choices are A, yes, B, no, and C, define senatorial. Last week's question was, is honest-to-goodness Indiana a good tourism brand? 69% said honest-to-goodness, 7% said WTH, 24% said, geez, we paid what for that? If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. The governor's plan for a pilot program of vouchers for early childhood education hit the skids this week. A state Senate committee voted to send the matter to a study committee. House Speaker Brian Bosma, in turn, indicated that House Republicans like that idea.
Even a major agreement for a major study of pre-kindergarten is actually a victory, because it's been difficult to get people at the table to hear and receive information and opinions in this regard.
John Ketzenberger, should the governor prepare for a defeat on pre-K?
Well, I think it's definitely a setback from his perspective, but I think it's probably a good idea when you're looking at, in the fall, revenue collections are down. They're still down. The governor said at that time that the state needed to watch its pennies. So to spend additional money on a program, any program, is something that the legislature wants to take a hard look at. I think that that's their stance right now. I think it only becomes a real defeat if next year they look at this and they say, no way. Then it's a definite defeat for the governor. Right now it's just a delay or a setback.
But when you look at what's going on with the governor's agenda, it appears he lacks a little influence in the General Assembly.
Maybe. I mean, you look back at his first year in office when he wanted a 10% personal income tax reduction, and the chambers were controlled by his own party, gave him 5%. But I think that's instructive because he was able to declare victory and say it was the largest right. tax decrease and tax cut in the state's history and take credit for it. So to echo what John says, it may be a setback, but because the governor, whoever the governor is, has the bully pulpit and the ability to a platform from which he or she can spin the message the way he or she wants, he can say when he goes around the state, I called for this, and because of that, we're having a study committee looking at this summer, and we will be well positioned to fund it come next session. I mean, that's. Okay.
But the folks on the third floor are sending a strong message that they're a separate branch of government.
Well, John Kitzberg had it right. I mean, the problem is with the revenue being down and there being a hefty price tag to all of the proposals that were made, it's very difficult to move forward with everything you want at that point. Nobody says this thing is dead. In fact, the original bill that came over the House, the program wouldn't start until after the next budget session anyway.
Right.
And so the problem that the Senate members had with this was they think it could have been crafted differently. For instance, they think instead of being controlled by the FSSA, it should be controlled by State Board of Education and then monitored by the Department of Education, for instance. And there were 10 things on that list that they offered in committee, and it passed unanimously. So obviously there are things people think they ought to look at, including funding sources and other things that go along with it. So I still think that you're going to end up with a pre-K program. It's going to happen when they originally planned for it to happen, but it'll be part
but based
of
on, but based but on action a, taken next year.
But it'll be a product that'll be studied over the summer, made better, and then it'll go through the normal budget process next year.
There is no question that the third floor has taken the governor and his people to school. I mean, they have not learned the lesson that when they're in session, it's a separate and equal branch of government. He thinks he can pontificate from the top of the mountain and they'll all scurry along behind him. And what they've shown him is that's not going to happen.
I'm not sure that's entirely fair, though, because remember, this is the guy who you've also criticized for putting up guardrails or parameters and letting the legislature do its will on certain issues.
But what you do with this, what you do with this, John, is you come out, you flesh out the idea, you bring the legislators in, you talk to them about it, you get their feedback and all, and then you announce it. That's not the way he operates.
And this is still going to happen.
Governor Pence is in Washington, D.C. to meet with Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius to talk about Medicaid. And that's why people from a coalition that calls itself Cover Indiana gathered outside the governor's office. They presented 10,000 petition signatures that request an expansion of Medicaid that could meet health insurance coverage for as many as 400,000 people who currently don't have it. They know that Governor Pence is not seeking a routine expansion of Medicaid, but rather seeking federal approval to use Medicaid money to expand the Healthy Indiana plan. Rob Stone, a doctor at IU Health, did the talking.
We support you to do the right thing here because the health of Indiana's people is a grave concern. We rank 41st out of 50 states in overall health.
John Schwana, should we expect a Healthy Indiana plan expansion to result from the Washington meeting?
Possibly. I mean, there have been other agreements have been struck of a similar nature in other states. However, and again, this gets into the spin, will it be an expansion of HIP or will it be a revision and an overhaul so that
it'll be a Medicaid expansion by another name.
Yeah,
that's what I'm
exactly.
saying, so that it more resembles, because there are several, it seems to me, deal breakers in HIP. One is their caps,
and the funding,
who pays, their caps, and there are certain types of medical procedures that aren't covered.
Not covered.
And those are all problematic,
right.
at least in terms of the definition as set up by the federal government.
But Kathleen Sebelius wouldn't be talking to Governor Pence if she wasn't open to something, right?
I think that's exactly right. This was set a long time ago. I'm sure that they've been talking regularly since. I think what you'll see is the completion of some kind of arrangement. I think that that's probably a good outcome for everyone because this money's going to be spent by the federal government regardless, and the state stood to lose an awful lot of money and have a lot of people who were without insurance and any coverage, there would have been a large effect on hospitals, doctors, people who are needing the service, and the state itself. So I think that's where it's headed.
From your perspective, is any expansion better than no expansion?
Oh, there's no question. I don't care whether he calls it Pence-cade. I don't care whether he's backed himself into a terrible corner on this, and he's taken 400,000 Hoosiers who could have health care coverage with him. It's unacceptable. I hope she throws him an olive branch so he can save face. I don't care what it's called. I don't, you know, there are parameters that aren't going to include copays and caps and the rest of that. But if we can get those 400,000 people covered, that is a huge boon for the state of Indiana, and I don't care what the name of it is.
Do both sides need to find middle ground?
Yes, and I think you're going to see a hybrid of what we've got and where the federal program is, and I think that's a good thing for Indiana. And it's also happened in other places, and I think that will be the result, or I'd be stunned if she would agree to the meeting just to slam the door.
Right. And as John points out, something's got to happen. It's not as if you don't get a resolution, people stop getting sick or having accidents or tragedies.
Or the money doesn't go someplace else.
And that's when you're going to have the increased pressure from the hospitals who are having to absorb the cost of care and others.
You're going to see some kind of program.
You'll have something, absolutely. Yeah.
The state Senate committee made big changes this week to a bill requiring drug testing for welfare recipients. The bill was amended so that only welfare recipients with misdemeanor drug convictions would now face mandatory testing. Even so, Democrats argued that the bill does nothing to protect children.
In order to protect them, you're going to take away the benefit that they have to sustain life. You can shake your head all you want, but somebody's going to lose benefits on this.
Nobody stands a risk of losing any benefits unless they are abusing drugs, whether they be prescription drugs or illegal drugs. Nobody's going to lose them unless they have this problem.
That's Representative Judd McMillan, preceded by State Senator Greg Taylor and Delaney. Why not use drug tests for welfare recipients? Why are Democrats opposed to that?
They have tried this in other states. It's a very, very costly program, and it doesn't result in massive use of drugs by people on welfare. The attitude of this, it seems to me, is pretty well reflected in the approach they take to this. It's just like there's something wrong with you because you're poor. And if only you were a better person, and if only you did what we think you should do, you would be a better person, and you wouldn't be on welfare.
Well, State Senator,
you know, it's ridiculous.
State Senator Mark Stoops said, if we're going to do this, why don't we drug test corporate executives who get state incentives?
Mike Young
is the sponsor in the
and
Senate.
He's got this right. What he's trying to do is get help
Lion
to the
hogs
people.
And acorns?
He's trying to get help to the people that need help, and there's a cycle here. And if somebody's a drug user and they're using what little money they get, taxpayer money, to feed their addiction instead of helping the people
well,
they're trying
to be
helped.
That's
the goal here, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And the way this system works, the problem is, you got it half right, the problem is it's very expensive to do this, and there are four different fiscal notes on this in its current form. And until they figure out exactly what the efficiencies
of this
are.
They've tried this in other states.
But
in
some places it has worked, and some places it hasn't.
It's viewed as a wedge issue.
It is a wedge issue.
Sure, because for reasons Ann articulated, it is seen as sort of, we have ours, and I'm not saying this is necessarily the way it is, we have ours, you don't,
that's
what's wrong
ridiculous.
With you? I think that's the way they look at it. I'm not saying it's accurate, but that's the framing.
This has been attempted before without success.
Right, and I'll be surprised if it succeeds this time. If it does, expect a challenge in the courts.
Finally, tragedy was averted inside Assembly Hall at Indiana University this week, hours before a scheduled men's basketball game with the University of Iowa. A 50-pound, 8-foot-long metal piece fell from the ceiling, damaging seats in a scene that was captured by an ESPN camera. No one was hurt, and the game was canceled, but a women's game was held the next night. School officials say melting snow is to blame. Mike McDaniel, on a scale of 1 to 10, how lucky was IU?
10. Clearly, that was amazing that it happened. When it did, it could have been a terrible tragedy, and I'm sure they'll do the right thing and get that prepared in a proper way. But, you know, boy, if you were sitting in those stands during that time that happened, that could have been awful for a lot of people.
they're planning a multi-million dollar renovation. Irony is there was a renovation meeting going on at the time.
Right, right. It shows you the renovations necessary. I mean, they, apparently those are decorative and they're all being removed. And Mike's right. They were very, very fortunate that it happened at an off time because it could have been catastrophic. And I don't think it was the weight of the banners on the wall that pulled it.
Nothing like, you know,
or wasn't Crane up there sawing it off?
Cody Zeller.
I noticed that Purdue has not had that problem.
Well, there have been plenty of attempts at humor here, including Cody Zeller, who tweeted that he could say that the programs have been collapsing since he left, but he wasn't going
to
do that.
Wow. That's an interesting take by the alumni.
Yeah.
There you go.
So it's now being called what?
Reassembly Hall. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/podcast, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shello of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.